kids listening to thousands, literally thousands of songs about heartbreak, rejection, pain, misery, and loss. Did I listen to pop music because I was miserable? Or was I miserable because I listened to pop music?
Well, music is my life, man. What do you want me to do?
Hello out there, you're listening to episode 15 of Love That Album, the podcast where I crap on about an album that I love, although maybe I'm thinking of throwing in a few things that I think are maybe just mediocre or adequate, so, you know, I don't know, just don't mind that album, doesn't have the same ring to the name, but never mind that, be that as it may. My name is Morris Bushtinski, and on every episode of this show, I always like to have a co-host join me. And on the other end of a Skype connection tonight, here I have with me a man who's getting to be a regular on the show and hopefully will continue to be such. I'm referring to the host of Sitting in a Bar in Adelaide, Michael Persh. Good evening, Michael.
Morris, how you going, mate? Always a pleasure to be a guest on your show. I have a ball doing this.
Fantastic. Well, we're quite happy to have you loving that album. How are things at that bar in Adelaide?
Always busy. I'm a very happy man. After 3 years of knocking on doors, I finally got an interview with Andy Scott from The Suite, so I'm a very happy camper.
Oh, fantastic. And not wanting too much to blow the Love That Album trumpet, but I believe that our discussion of another great album helped you score an interview. Is that the case?
It is, yes. Yes, indeed. Well, it hasn't happened yet, but I've got an offer to be on the program from Fee Wabel from the Tubes.
Oh,
after I sent him a link to our show about remote control, so very happy about that as well.
That is so exciting. I can't wait to hear that. And more to the point, I can't wait for you to send me the email that says, it's happening on such and such a day. Here's a guaranteed cert.
So I expect some good Tubes questions from you to help me out.
I will definitely throw a few your way. That should be really fantastic. And judging from a couple of interviews that I've seen with him online or read transcribed, he's an entertaining guy, and I'm sure he's going to give you more than single word answers or single sentence answers. He'll definitely have a lot of great stories to tell about the San Franciscan music scene of the day.
Looking forward to it indeed.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. All right, but the focus of our show tonight is going to be from a great album that means a lot to both of us, not just because, I guess, of the quality of the album, of which there is much, but because I guess it recalls a fond time musically for us both growing up, I guess. I'm referring to Broderick Smith's Big Combo.
Indeed, and maybe an interesting one for your listeners in far-flung corners of the world, because the chances are they don't know who Broderick Smith is, and I hope we open up their ears, because there's a lot of Broderick Smith history, and man, he is a great singer indeed.
Yeah, for sure. Well, what we'll do before we go to just talking a little bit about Broderick and his past, I always like to start off the show by asking, what have you been listening to over the past couple of weeks?
Well, for no real reason, I've had a bit of a 70s vinyl fest happening, and I pulled out my very old battered copy of Venus and Mars the other day.
Oh, right.
And loved every second of it. I sat down with a pair of headphones and listened to the whole album and realized how much I loved it. And we spoke, I think, a couple of episodes ago about McCartney's new album and that his releases are a little bit patchy. But for me, the string of Wings albums from Red Rose Speedway and Band on the Run and Venus and Mars, there's just great song after great song after great song. So that's, for me, that's the the purple patch of McCartney's work. So I really enjoyed listening to Venus and Mars again.
I don't remember if I ever told you this story, but back when, you know, back in the day of McCartney being very popular, I had a neighbour who I was a very good friend of, and we all, you know, she was a big Beatles nut, and we're, you know, big fans of their solo work and the like. And I'll never forget, she was telling me that she was in a record shop one day and overheard these two schoolgirls, and one was saying to the other one, "You know, I hear that Paul McCartney was in a band before Wings." So I mean, we, you know, we tend to forget about the legacy and all that he's done, and you know, I mean, of course, you know, the Beatles is really what's central to a lot of our hearts, but there was that period in the 70s, and I know he's mocked and derided, and, you know, okay, to be fair, McCartney has released a lot of turkeys along the way, but a lot of those Wings albums, you know, they were quite melodic, and but he could also rock out, and, you know, no matter what else, whatever turkeys he might have released on record, the man has always put on a great concert.
Indeed, indeed. And there's a tune on there called Letting Go on Venus and Mars, which is a real great rock and roll riff, and I'd forgotten about the tune, and it was flogged on the radio here in Adelaide in 75 when Wings came out here, and it's one of those tunes. I think it's, you know, just slipped under everybody's radar. It's a killer guitar riff.
But I have recollections of hanging out at the local swimming pool. I think it was Carnegie Swimming Pool. When I was, I don't know, maybe about 10 or 11 in the summer of the year that Venus and Mars got released. And, you know, everyone lying around the pool would have their radios all turned onto 3XY, the big radio station for rock fans of the day, and hearing that song always played on the radio. I mean, I always heard, you know, at home as well, but for some reason, that's the image burnt of me in my memory when I hear that song is just, you know, being at the Carnegie Swimming Pool back in the day. It's incredible the memories that certain songs will dredge up for you.
And exactly the same for me, mate. It got played so much here on the radio in that summer way back then. God, it seems so long ago indeed.
So what else have you been listening to?
The other one I pulled out was Born to Run. Now, I have listened, and you're probably going to chastise me here, but I really struggle with this album. I love the tunes on it, but the production for me is just cluttered, and every time I listen to it, I think I should love this record. And Thunder Road is my favourite Springsteen tune, full stop. But I just find the arrangement really difficult, and I still struggle with it. And I sat down and listened to the whole album again, and really didn't change my mind. But yeah, it's got so many great tunes on it, and I guess My favourite Springsteen album is Nebraska, for the reason that it's just laid back. It's got everything stripped away from it, and it just shows, without anything else, what a great writer Springsteen is. And I guess, yeah, maybe I'm a bit simplistic with that, and I don't appreciate what the rest of the E Street Band does, but there you go.
No, look, insofar as the production work goes on that album, I think I have to agree with you on that. You know, certainly, yeah, there are a lot of great tunes on that album, but yeah, look, the production does suffer a bit. But then, I don't know. I mean, I think, like, my favourite of the Springsteen albums, if you go all the way back to episode one, where myself and Jeff Jenkins were having the debate as to which was the better album between Darkness on the Edge of Town and The Wild, the Innocent, and The E Street Shuffle, and of course, I put in the big votes for The Wild, the Innocent, and The E Street Shuffle. But you know, the production values on that are probably even worse than Born to Run. And yet, because the music is so majestic and the band arrangements are so great, and they had, you know, such a talented keyboard player like David Sanchez and the big man Clarence Clemons. I think that was his first album, The Wild, the Innocent. It just, all the ingredients came together so you could overlook those production values. And I think the same can be true of Born to Run. That's why it's such a favourite of a lot of people, because there's the poetry and there's the majesty of the music. I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm being a pretentious wanker, but really, I mean, there's nothing else that can be said about that music at the time. And then when he went off to Darkness on the Edge of Town, He sort of dropped a lot of that poetry, a lot of those mini films in song, and started sort of going for the more straight ahead. I mean, there were still stories to be told, make no mistake, but the real poetry, I think, is in those first three albums.
And it did. I guess the one thing that really struck me, and I guess it was on my mind because Clarence recently passed away, that, you know, he just shone on that album. The saxophone solos on Born to Run are just fantastic, and it really made me sort of my ears prick up. That, you know, this, yeah, he really was something special.
He's definitely missed. I'm not sure who it is that supposed to be replacing, if there can ever be a replacement for a.
I actually read that he's taking a complete horn section out in the road, not one single single player. So
it takes a whole whole horn section to match up to the big man.
So right.
Now I don't know if you ever saw this, but you know, back in the day when my kids were really really young, I used to buy them Sesame Street albums, and they had a couple of albums which had. I guess parodies, if you will, of iconic rock albums. So there was Sesame Road, which had, you know, Cookie and Grover and, you know, a couple of the others, you know, walking across Abbey Road. But even better is an album called Born to Wag, which has a picture of Bert in the Springsteen pose and Cookie Monster in the Clarence Clemens pose. Absolutely just fantastic. Have a look on the net. There's bound to be a photo of it somewhere.
Sweet. Fantastic.
Look, it is a wonderful album, nevertheless. And my favorite track on that album is a thing called Meeting Across the River. Really sweet. I think just with Professor Roy Bittan on the piano and Clarence Clemens on the sax, and really passionate vocal from Bruce. That's... oh, wow. I think I'm going to have to go out and listen to that album, I think, again tomorrow. Oh, gosh. So, great choice, great choice. Anything else?
The other one that I dragged out, the other LP, was, and I'd pretty well forgotten that I owned it, was Ride a Rock Horse by Roger Daltrey.
Okay. I've not heard any, apart from the album Under a Raging Moon, I don't think I've heard any solo Daltrey.
It's, and again, back about 75, and it was... Well, certainly here in Adelaide, it got a lot of airplay. There was a tune on it called Come and Get Your Love, which is a fantastic tune. And a lot of it, reading the cover notes, a lot of it is co-written, and one of the main players, and I've got a feeling he produced it, was Russ Ballard, who in the 80s and 90s was a very, very popular songwriter and musician and collaborator with a lot of people. But I don't recall hearing his name before that, so I'd forgotten that he was on this album, but it's really worth checking out. I know you're a Who fan, so go and check it out. It's got a cover of Walking the Dog on it, which is really, to cover such a well known tune is pretty brave. But Dolphy does a damn fine job of it, so it's well worth checking out.
I'd heard, I mean, as I said, apart from that Under a Raging Moon, I'd heard that a lot of Daltrey's filling in time between Who albums, solo albums, were more ballad in nature. Is that correct?
This one is very much a rock album. I think the first couple, you know, he did. Leo Sayer wrote a lot of, he covered a lot of Leo Sayer's tunes early on.
Really?
In the 70s, yeah. And, but this one was, quite rocky. I think Russ Ballard had a lot to do with that. So I guess it's available on CD. I certainly can't recall ever seeing it, but. Yeah, worth laying your hands on.
Okay, all right. Some interesting things that you've been listening to over the last couple of weeks. I'll quickly go over just a couple of things that I've been listening to. Now, in the course of our conversations, I went and went and recorded from a couple of my old vinyl albums for you. A couple of albums by an old Melbourne group called Pyramid Jazz. Well, I don't know. Would you call them jazz fusion?
Yeah, I would. And thank you so much. I enjoyed every second of them.
Well, so they're a band out of Melbourne. I think they're out of Melbourne. And they featuring The absolute creme de la creme of the local jazz community, featuring a pre-whispering Jack David Hirschfelder on piano and keyboards and all other manner of key-related instruments. I think he pretty much took up most of the compositional duties. And David Jones on drums, a man who we both admire exceptionally. And who else? Roger McLaughlin on bass, and Bob Venier on trumpet, who I'm pretty sure had a quite a successful career on the Steve Vizard Tonight Show. Certainly, he went into TV for a while. But yeah, look, I when I was recording those for you, ripping those to CD for you, I found myself sort of, you know, I hadn't listened to them in ages, and I just sort of. I mean, a couple of tracks sort of seemed a bit dated, but I went back and listened to it. I thought, wow, I really remember why I liked these guys so much. Because I guess a lot of the jazz fusion of the day, and I was a big fan of fusion at the time, but these guys were, you know, a little bit different, because I guess most jazz fusion bands tended to have front and center some hotshot guitar player to lure in the rock punters to listen to them. And Pyramid didn't do that. They had you know, David Hirschfelder's keyboards front and center, or Bob Venier's trumpet, and yet they still had a lot of that fusion feel about them. And so yeah, their two albums, one was called well, just self-titled Pyramid, and the other one was called Sunshower, which was recorded for an ABC TV show. I think I think you might actually, correct me if I'm wrong, Don Burrows was originally from South Australia, wasn't he?
I don't know.
No, Don Burrows, who's a big jazz flute player back in the day, hosted a series of TV specials for the ABC, and you know, he was the host of this show that Pyramid went and did, and the result of that TV show ended up on this great vinyl record, which I'm pretty sure that neither of their records have actually made it to CD. So yeah, I'm quite precious about those two albums.
I'll have to go searching. I had no idea that Don Burrows was from this part of the world.
Look, I might be wrong, but I have a feeling that he's originally South Australia. Certainly, if he's not from there originally, I'm pretty sure I heard that he had a long association with South Australia. So,
not Don Bradman, you're thinking about?
No. Oh, yeah, that Don. Yeah, sorry. All right, Albert. So you get the cream of sport and the cream of music. How about that?
And Roger McLaughlin, mate, what a fantastic bass player he is. He's not appreciated in Australia for what a fine bass player. He's probably most well known for a brief stint in the Little River Band, but
that's right.
There's nothing that man can't play. And David and Roger as a rhythm section, I could listen to those two CDs and take out the other two instruments and just listen to the rhythm section. They were unbelievable.
Oh, you're sure you're not a little bit biased there, are you, Michael?
Well, just the way they work together, and I know they're good friends and they've played together a lot, and you can hear it. There is an empathy between the way they play together that's just absolutely magnificent. I love those two albums indeed. Mm-hmm. And we spoke about Midas Touch the other day.
Oh, yes.
Website, and I've seen Pyramid mentioned on there, and that, you know, that's where I think I first actually heard of them, for those guys bringing up the name of the group.
Okay, I might have to go back to the website. Was it mentioned quite recently?
No, quite a few years ago.
Okay, right, but yeah, all their records, all their posts are still up. That's quite a good resource. I really like Midas Touch. In fact, I think I actually remember one time seeing Dan Kelly, as in Paul's nephew, you know, putting up some notes, and everyone was really chuffed. Oh, we have music royalty on our forum. And he said, oh, yes, there's nothing better than what myself and my Uncle Paul like to do than have a look through Midas Touch once in a while. And I think everyone's quite chuffed with that. Excellent. All right, so, yeah, look, another album that I've been pulling out a bit recently, I think it came out back in, I'd say 2010, Keeping it jazz, and certainly keeping it Melbourne this time, is a guy called Joe Kindamo. Now, a lot of people will know Joe Kindamo from, I'm pretty sure he was Oh, no, that wasn't him. I was going to say he was on the Steve Izard show. No, that was Count Paul Grabowski. But Joe Kendama, I'm sure, has done some television work. But he played piano in another great Melbourne jazz fusion band called Changes, which featured our man Virgil Donati on drums. But I remember once going to a wedding and seeing him playing in the reception band. And I went up to him and said, "You're Joe Kendama. Why are you playing in a reception band? You're the great jazz player." And he said, "Mate, someone has to put food on the table. And loose change is not going to put food on the table." So there you go. See, he's playing
That's
weddings.
A great story.
But yeah, look, a very, very super talented musician and arranger. And so there's an album that he put out a couple of years ago. He's put out a few great albums, but the two that really stick out in my mind, there's one where he's done jazz versions of Paul Simon tunes. I think the name of the album is called The Paul Simon Songbook. And so it's just him and a trio. I can't remember who's on bass, but on drums is a really insanely talented Melbourne jazz drummer called Dave Beck, who I've had the pleasure of seeing a number of times. The album I've been listening to of recent is called Another Place, Some Other Time. And this is an album that will be especially of interest to listeners overseas or listeners locally for that matter who are fans of the Coen brothers. So Joe Kendama had been watching Fargo for the umpteenth time, and he just found himself absolutely adoring the music. And Fargo probably has in my mind the best score out of all the Coen brothers films, but all the Coen brothers films have great music in them. And a friend suggested to him that maybe he ought to be putting together an album of his interpretations of the Carter Burwell music that had been scored for all the Coen brothers movies. And that's exactly what he did. It's not all straight jazz. In fact, very little of it actually is jazz, but it's done with a jazz musician's sensibility, and the instrumentation and the arrangements are just absolutely brilliant. There's even a couple of tunes from the Oh Brother Where Art Thou soundtrack, and really you can't imagine those being done in jazz fashion, and they're not. But as I said, it's just done with a jazz musician's attention to detail and sensibility, and there's just some fantastic stuff. And what I mentioned before about Fargo, the main thing from that is just some of the most beautiful music I've ever heard in a film. What's the other track? Fantastic. If you've seen The Big Lebowski, and that you hear in that film the Gypsy Kings doing their interpretation of Hotel California, so has Joe Kendama doing his interpretation of the Gypsy Kings' interpretation of Hotel California. So this is a really fantastic album. If you're listening overseas, I urge you to maybe go to an Australian retailer's website and search for it. Kendama is spelled Chindamo, and the name of the album is called Another Place, Some Other Time. And if you're a fan of the Coen brothers, this is really an album that you want to hear. It's really, really wonderful stuff. And finally, I guess this is also filmic related, I have a great 3-CD box set called Superbad, which is, as the title would imply, music from blaxploitation films of the early 70s. So if you've ever watched any of the great films like Shaft or Coffee or Foxy Brown, then you've really gone and enjoyed that music, then yeah, this is a great 3-CD box set. Although I think there's really quite a lot of great albums out there which are compilations of tunes from those early 70s blaxploitation films. So don't have to search out Superbad necessarily, although it is a great place to start, but there's a lot out there that you can search for. All right, well, there you go. That's what we've been listening to over the last couple of weeks. So what do you reckon? Should we be talking a bit about Broderick Smith?
We should indeed.
All right, what we'll do is we'll take a quick break and come back and do a little bit of talk about Broderick Smith, and then lead into his album of 1981, Broderick Smith's Big Combo. You're listening to Michael and Morris on Love That Album. We'll be back in a minute.
When you're watching movies, are you sick of remakes, reboots, reimaginings, reinventions, and Reese Witherspoon? Are you fed up with movies where giant robots try to remake Enter the Dragon? Do you think that torture porn is vastly inferior to 1970s drive-in porn? Do you find Botoxed actresses with fake tits and action heroes with no chest hair a turn-off? Do movies where no single shot lasts more than 2.5 seconds piss you off? Yeah, me too. That's why I do Paleo Cinema Podcast, a podcast for films more than 20 years old. So if you think that Sid Charisse is a guy and that Myrna Loy is a kind of metal, you need Paleo Cinema Podcast. Go to paleo-cinema.com and do yourself a favour.
Okay, welcome back. You're listening to episode 15 of Love That Album. Morris here, Michael over there in Adelaide. And the focus of tonight's episode is Broderick Smith's Big Combo, the album from 1981. But by the time Brod came to record the Big Combo album and indeed put together the Broderick Smith's Big Combo band, he was no newcomer on the scene. He'd been around for quite a while, the most famous of his groups being the Dingoes. But look, I perceive, Michael, that you're more of an expert on his background than I am. So want to give us a little bit of a history, potted history of Broderick Smith.
Well, I certainly wouldn't say I'm an expert, and I'm interested to find out where you first heard Broderick, because I remember as probably a 10-year-old watching Sunbury on the television, and I don't particularly remember the Dingoes, but when I go back and think about it, maybe I do. I guess at that age there was a lot of bare-breasted women running around, and that sort of grabbed my attention a little bit more than the what was happening musically. But anyway,
it's our Woodstock all over again.
Indeed, but the Dingoes left Australia, I think, about 75, and spent quite a time in the United States, and I first really remember hearing a tune called Smooth Sailing, which got a reasonable amount of play on the radio, but didn't really sell all that well from memory. Mm. And I had no idea they were an Australian band. The song sounded very, very much in the vein of Little Feat and the stuff that was coming out of maybe the south of the United States at that time. Mm. Mm. And that got me to go searching and find a bit more about the Dingoes and Broderick Smith, of course, and what a fantastic band of musicians they are. And if you go back in Australian rock history, Broderick Smith was in a band called Carson before that, which I guess were more of a bluesy sort of country band, but a great band and very much loved indeed in the very early 70s. So,
do you have any of their material?
A little bit, not... maybe half a dozen tunes on bits and pieces. There's quite a bit of stuff come out in recent years from GTK, the black and white television show from the ABC in the early 70s. And, I've got a few bits and pieces from that, and maybe our mates at Midas Touch have got a bit of Carson kicking around. I certainly haven't got a full album, and I don't recall ever seeing one, but I'm sure they're out there somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Okay, look, you went and asked what my first memory of Broderick Smith was. Look, I'd actually seen him, you know, years before I'd realised I'd seen him, because I think, you know, in a recent discussion that we had, I mentioned, and Midas Touch, once again, was responsible for reminding me of this, was, I think, about 73 or thereabouts, Tommy was, there was a production of it here in Melbourne at the Maya Music Bowl, and they got the cream of Australian rock talent to perform in this, and I think they'd even gone and lured Keith Moon to come to Australia to do Uncle Ernie. But they did a production of it, and I think with full band and orchestra, and I think that Broderick Smith was playing as Captain Walker, if I recall correctly. But certainly, you know, back when I watched that, I didn't know who any of these people were. And can you imagine? I think it was Darryl Braithwaite as Tommy.
I've got the recording somewhere. I need to dig it out again. Mm.
He seems like a logical fit for Roger Daltrey, wouldn't you say?
Well, maybe not
as rocky, but certainly is. You know, he had the looks. He had the looks that got the girls screaming.
Darryl Braithwaite is. I actually went and saw Darryl Braithwaite a couple of years ago, and was prepared to be unexcited and. And by the end of the, and it was a, a Thursday night, a very small crowd, very, very a sleepy crowd. And by the end of the night, he had every person in that room on their feet. And, man, he's a great singer. I was really impressed.
Yep. So after that production of Tommy, I think the first time I really recall being aware of Broderick and thinking, man, this guy's got a voice, was during a concert in tribute to the late guitar player and songwriter Andy Durant. Now, for those of you overseas who don't know who Andy Durant is, and that's probably just about all of you, there was a band in the mid to late 70s, country. They were probably modelled themselves on the slightly a combination between the American West Coast sound and maybe crossed with, you know, the Allman Brothers a bit, called Stars. And they were a wonderful band. I mean, I remember their big top 40 hit from their first album was a song called Mighty Rock. And I couldn't get enough of that song. Absolutely loved it. And the songwriter behind that was this guy Andy Durant, who I think he was the band's rhythm guitar player. The lead guitar player was a guy called Mal Eastick, who, curiously enough, turns up in Broderick Smith's Big Combo. But anyway, so unfortunately, Andy Durant passed away of was it bone cancer? Certainly some form of cancer. And Mal Eastick of the lead guitar player of Stars decided to put together an all-star rock concert at Melbourne's Palais Theatre to raise money for cancer research for the Peter MacCallum Cancer Clinic here in Melbourne. And all money from tickets raised, plus all money raised from copies of the record that got released afterwards, all went to the research. I think the DVD only just came. Oh, this is back in, 1980, I think. And I think the DVD itself got released like about, 3 years ago, two, 3 years ago. I think even to this day, the sales from the DVD might be going towards cancer research. So it's a really good thing that Mal Eastick has tirelessly championed for. But anyway, so one of the all-star cast of the Andy Durant Memorial Concert was Broderick Smith. And he came on to do, everyone was on stage at some time singing background vocal or something, but I think his lead songs included a tune called Jupiter Creek, which Stars had recorded, and a song that I don't think Stars ever got round to recording. It might have been one of the last things Andy had written, a song called Ocean Deep. And, maybe apart from the song that Ian Moss sings called Solitaire, I'd say Ocean Deep is probably my favourite song in the whole set, and maybe even has it over Solitaire.
And there is a co-write, a part composition of Andy Durant's on this album.
Yes, there is. We'll have to get to that. Absolutely. So, and I think the album might have even been, if you look in the liner notes, it says In Remembrance of Andrew Durant and Alan Aldenhoven. I'm not sure who he is, but obviously Andy was someone who meant a lot to a lot of people in the local music community back in the day. And Broderick came on and sang this absolutely gorgeous song. I mean, it's only three chords, I think, just an E, D, A, that's it, over and over again, but played on these beautiful 12-string guitars and some really nice cymbal work and lovely little bit of pedal steel work on there. And it's just absolutely gorgeous. And Broderick sings like his life is depending on it. He's just gentle where he has to be, and then he comes into the chorus with this full-on, I won't say operatic, but really he's fully on dramatic voice. And I just thought, wow, this guy's the highlight. He was definitely the highlight of the whole concert. And I mean, really, there were no slackers in this lineup. You know, you had three members of Chisel who were just really striking it big with East back at the time. All the ex-members of Stars themselves, Renee Geyer, Richard Clapton, I can't recall who else, but really just a lot of fantastic musicians from the day. and but Broderick, in my mind, I think just stood out amongst the whole lot of them. Yeah, fantastic song, Ocean Deep. So indeed. Yep, so there you go. Rather long answer to a rather short question, but that was my first memory of hearing Broderick Smith. And then a year later came out this this album, Broderick Smith's Combo, and I thought, wow, he's that guy. I better go buy this.
So it sounds like we need to do this, do an episode of this program about Land of Fortune by Stars. Then, in my humble opinion, one of the best Australian albums ever made.
Look, you know, I'm going to have to disagree with you on that, because I'd take Paradise over Land of Fortune any day. But maybe that's what we need to do, is have, you know, like the first episode where we did, where Jeff Jenkins and myself compared the two Springsteen albums. Maybe we need to compare track by track the two Stars albums, because certainly a very small app, which is two albums, an EP and a live album, I think.
Yeah, and much loved. They were local lads, in fact. And I grew up with Mal Eastick.
Mm.
And Jupiter Creek is actually written about a real place about 5 kilometres from where I live. So,
hang on, when you say you grew up with Mal Eastick, you mean you grew up listening to him, or you grew up with Mal Eastick?
I know his family and grew up with his sister, and he played at my high school when the band, before they had, I think they had their first single out.
Wow. Ladies and gentlemen, I had no idea that I'm podcasting with rock and roll royalty.
I don't think so.
I bow down to you, Michael Pirsch.
But Mal Eastick is one of my favourite guitar players. He can do no wrong, and he is a... I think his health hasn't been too good in recent years, and I've had the pleasure of having him on my show, and he's a wonderful man and a wonderful player indeed. But we shall talk more about Stars at another time.
All right, we will. All right, I think it's been a rather short lead into Broderick Smith's Big Combo, but what we'll do is we'll have just another quick break, and then we'll go into talking about the album of the episode, Broderick Smith's Big Combo, in some detail. You're listening to Love That Album.
American Dream. He's just a common man.
This is the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes. I'm coming to you live in a living color. Speak to you. The American People, a podcast called Silver and Gold Daddy. And you know that the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes, knows how to bring home the gold, Daddy. And just like Henry Silver sticking Bobby Boucher's head inside a sow hanging from the ceiling, Silver and Gold will stick it to you. Stick it to your ears, stick it to your mouth, your eyes, your nose, Daddy, and all points in between. They'll take your listening pleasure and stick it between a sow's carcass hanging from the ceiling, Daddy.
Silver and Gold, we talk about movies and shit. Find us on iTunes or silverandgold.com.
Welcome back to Love That Album. Morris here in Melbourne, Michael there in Adelaide. And we're going to talk now in some detail about the album Broderick Smith's Big Combo. Now, I keep saying this, but for you listeners overseas who don't know who he is and trying to think, well, why should I care about this album that I haven't heard? An interesting story. I mean, look, I'd had the vinyl album for many, many years. And I think, was it last year that the album got re-released on CD with, you know, really sadly, only one bonus track. I think there was a B-side, but as part of the wonderful Aztec Music Collection, who, you know, they're really the Rhino Records of Australia. They're just absolutely doing so much good preserving Australian rock music heritage. But I went and bought the CD, you know, get it all remastered and having it sounding great. And I put it on, and my wife, who never heard Broderick Smith or never even heard of him, said to me, oh, is this a new Bruce Springsteen album? So I'm not sure what Broderick thinks of that comparison, but where do you see that?
My guess would be he wouldn't be too impressed. I can see why people would say that. And I guess it's the the twin keyboard sound, the Hammond and the electric piano, give it that sort of sound.
And well, their initials are the same. I mean, you know, come on.
If I can just quickly mention, mate, for folks in the United States, we spoke briefly before about the Dingoes, Broderick Smith's band.
Yes.
And folks in the United States may find this interesting, that the Dingoes more or less broke up and came back to Australia from the States, but they toured around a lot with Little Feat, but they felt like they were on the verge of breaking it big. And I spoke to Chris Stockley, the guitar player, many years ago about this, and the Dingoes were booked to do a national tour with Lynyrd Skynyrd, who would have just broken them apart. Everyone who saw Lynyrd Skynyrd would have loved the Dingoes, and as history knows, the plane crash that killed Ronnie Van Zant and half of the band, that tour didn't happen. The tour company went broke. The Dingoes didn't get to go out and play.
But they kept their lives.
And they, well, yeah, and they came back to Australia in tatters. So it's a fascinating story that there was an Australian connection with that tragic event that happened to Lynyrd Skynyrd all the way back then. So, yeah, I thought, and I didn't know that until I actually spoke with Chris Stockley, so I thought it was fascinating.
Just also as an aside, I think that it's only like in the last year or so that Karen Tolhurst has finally come back to Australia to live permanently, because I think once, you know, post-Dingoes, I think he stayed in America, at least, you know, for living. But
in Arizona, I think.
But he's now here permanently. I mean, I know he'd come back off and on for gigs and the like, but yeah, he's now back here permanently, and even has his own band in his name, you know, the Karen Tolhurst Band. I haven't heard the album yet, but
fine player he is.
He is. Have you heard his own album?
I haven't, but I saw the Dingoes last year or the year before, and man, they were good.
I bet. All right, so let's get into the album proper. So look, the opening of the album, I really love a great album opener. I mean, I know it sounds like insanely obvious to say, but a great album opener will set the tone for what you think of the rest of the album. And it can be a gentle opener, that's fine, but there's got to be something about that opening song that really makes you want to keep it on. The first track, you think, this is no good, well, you won't give it another chance, you won't go, so I'll see how the rest of it goes. Often the opening track will make it or break it. It sounds obvious to say, and I'm not saying anything terribly new here, but I really love the fact that this album just really grabs you straight off. Opening song is called Last Train from Mobile Town. And I guess, you know, like a lot of songs that involve trains, either literally or metaphorically, I love the fact that they use the rhythm section to drive the rhythm sounding like a train. I know that some people think, oh yeah, that's so cliched, it's been done before, but damn, it's so good here. And it comes up quietly. It's a fade-in. I also love songs that are fade-ins. And you've got Brod's drummer, John Annis, chugging away on the snare there, and Mick O'Connor on the organ. Just absolutely this fantastic pace before the band fully comes in. And it really does sound like a moving train. And I guess like a lot of songs about trains, the whole thing is a metaphor of moving on in life. You know, he wants to leave this shit town that he's never been happy in, and he just sees his future ahead going somewhere else. He has it's a great opening line. Listen to the trains go rolling free, breaking the chain between this town and me. Gasoline rainbow in the sky over the fields where the dead cars lie. I mean, the Springsteen comparison, it holds true for that. That is such a Springsteen-type lyric.
Indeed. And it is a killer opener song, and was a killer live song. And the signature sound of Broderick Smith's big combo was that piano and Hammond, and it's here from the start. It sets itself up, and it's just wham, in your face. But again, John Annis, what a fantastic drummer he is. I first saw him with Kevin Borich.
Okay.
Kevin Borich Express, and man, and I guess he's still going around. I'm not sure what he's up to, but what a fantastic drummer, and he really, really keeps this song just way up there. Fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Probably just as a little. So I've got him written a note here. I mean, it's probably not necessarily related to the song or the track, but because I love the whole theme of these songs that I write. I can't stand my old town. I'm going to move on. And probably the other song in that vein that really does it for me is the Simon and Garfunkel reunion song of 1975, My Little Town. There's something fascinating about people sort of not necessarily looking happily on their life and just sort of thinking, I'm moving ahead, try to find a better life for myself. But in both cases, Paul Simon in My Little Town's case and Broad in this case, really paints a fantastic picture, rather than just saying, I'm not happy, I'm moving on, but he really paints a beautiful picture about why the town seems so grey to him, and he really has a great way with a lyric on this song.
Indeed, and it does. There's a lot of great examples on what a great lyricist Broderick Smith is, and his many solo albums since show that in spades. There's just too many to mention, and he really carries on that tradition.
Mm. Okay, so we'll go to the second track on the album. Is the song that was actually, I don't know if this is, was this the first single, Faded Roses, or the second single?
I think it may have been the second. I'm not, right. Can't really remember.
Well, we agree it was one of the singles from the album.
Most definitely.
Faded Roses. It's so after sort of this full-on oral assault, Faded Roses is considerably gentler, although when it gets to the chorus, Broderick Smith still has that passionate vocal about it. But the song opens up with, actually I should point out, he has a pianist in the group called Chris Wilson. And it's not the Chris Wilson not the famous Melbourne singer, and if this were a just world, he'd be famous all around the world. But this is a different Chris Wilson. However, sort of making the link, I think that the Melbourne Chris Wilson singer is probably the heir to Broderick Smith's legacy. I mean, I know Brod's still out there and he's still working and all that, but I see so many commonalities between the two. Both of them have a lot of great drama in their voice. Both of them sing passionately their roots music, and both of them are kings of harmonica in their respective
field.
But anyway, so I'm not talking about that Chris Wilson. I'm talking about the Chris Wilson piano player in the combo, and he opens up with this beautiful melody. And so, Faded Roses, it's a great breakup song. And what I like about it, what's so clever about the lyric here, is that he doesn't come right from the first verse into singing, right, I'm breaking up with you, or you're breaking up with me, or our life is not good anymore. He paints a picture. I love that. The lyric, I'm going to be quoting lyrics all night, but it's really appropriate. He sings, in a burnt out cafe on the dirty side of town, the moon was struggling to cut the gloom like the way you tried to cut me down. So he's painting the picture. Wow, things are not really good there. Where's this leading to? Ah, boom, the way you tried to cut me down. Ah, it's going to be a relationship song. But it's just, I love being able to sit there, shut my eyes and think, well, right, I can see that. I can see that lousy cafe. I can see it's a one-horse town. There's a pub, there's a town, there's a post office. It's in the middle of winter, whatever. But it just sounds fantastic. I love that painted picture before he gets to the nastiness.
And that's one thing about Broderick Smith, indeed, that, this is a great example. You could make a movie out of this song, one song, couldn't you?
You absolutely could. I don't actually recall seeing a film clip for it. I don't know whether, I imagine they would have done one, but do you remember seeing one? Was it a visual interpretation of the song, or was it just...
No, I think all the film clips I remember were just performance stuff.
Okay. No, but yeah, this could have made a really nice short film, a really nice short film clip.
Indeed, and it strikes me as, it'd make a great country tune. Johnny Cash could have done this.
Oh my God, you're right, he could have.
There's quite a few songs on the album that are co-writes with a guy by the name of Tony Slavich, and I know him from his association with Mike Rudd, and a very talented man he is as well. So One of Spectrum, I guess, are most loved in Australia, but Aerial was a band of Mike's in the mid-70s that I loved, and Tony was part of that, so I was very chuffed to see his name on some of these tunes.
Mm. Well, actually, I mean, when you look at, like, he's responsible for co-writes for both the singles on the album and the song that, we'll get to it, but it's, you know, probably the crowning jewel of the album, but we'll get to that in due course. This is absolutely just a gorgeous one. As I mentioned, it takes to the final line of that first verse to get to the heart of the matter, of the subject matter. You know, the mood is set, you're uncomfortable, right, here's the breakup or the aftermath of this relationship. And it's not going to be pretty, folks. He then goes on to sing, "You said I was a stranger, not the dreamer that you knew. Well, everybody has to change. Each blow will leave its scar on you." And, what a great lyric. But, you know, the thing is, more and more that I listen to songs told in the first person, I think, you know what, I'd like to hear, like, a song that comes back. So, well, that's your side of the story. You're painting me as someone who you fell out of love with because, you know, you didn't have it for me anymore. Well, you know, it's all your fault, but I'd like to see what the comeback would be. But as it is on this song, we get Broderick's side of the story. "Now, faded roses may fill the sky for the few who have a dreamer's eye. Yes, faded roses may fill the sky. Walk on out that door and leave me with my pride." Really, the romanticist in him is long gone. You know, romance is for suckers. This is the reality of life, folks. This is not an "I miss you" song. It's a get out of my life song. I'm a real sucker. I love a great love song, but I'm also a real sucker for a great breakup song.
And it's so Broderick Smith. I've had the very great pleasure of having him on my show, and he is just the most hilarious guy, and very, very, very. I guess his humour is very understated, but he's a very clever man, and just an absolute joy to talk to. And this lyrically, this tune just sums him up for me, I think.
All right. Excuse me. So, the next song, Tightrope. This starts off with a great drum and organ riff. It almost sounds like a little bit of a circus feel to it, don't you think?
Indeed, and again, showing off John Anderson's drumming. But this is actually my favourite song, and I love this. It's for me, it could be a Van Morrison tune. I know that Broderick Smith loves Van Morrison. The big combo used to do a great version of Into the Mystic, and I think there's actually a recording of that kicking around somewhere. And man, that was good. And this to me maybe subconsciously is him paying homage to the great Van Morrison.
You know, that's actually, I hadn't thought about that before, but I guess, you know, Van Morrison would be a great comparison. So you reckon that Broderick isn't a grumpy old man though, like Van is?
I wouldn't call him a grumpy old man by any stretch. It's interesting, I first contacted him a few years ago to see if he'd talk about the Dingoes and the big combo, and he was not blunt, but very, you know, very succinct, as a, "I'd rather not, thanks, but, you know, thanks but no thanks." And I contacted him maybe 2 years after regarding some solo work of his, and had a lovely chat to him, and he was really very generous with me and very funny and told me lots of great stories. But I still really had to push him to talk about the Dingoes, even though that was just after the Dingoes reunion of a couple of years ago. So an interesting character. But he did mention one thing that sort of summed him up for me. He said, I know you're a Rock Whiz fan. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you've been on the show.
I indeed have. It was Julia Zemira is the one woman who my wife will permit me to to go gaga over.
Fantastic. Well, Broderick told me that they had approached him on many, many occasions to be on the show, and he just said, "Nah, I don't want to do that. It's rubbish."
Oh, and, really?
And when he finally did it, he said, "Oh, I don't really care." And he got up there with you know, nothing to prove, nothing to sell. And he said, you know, "I could just be myself and you know, just he said he enjoyed every second of it and had a ball. So I thought that was, you know, that really sums up Broderick Smith for me, is that he is his own man. And you know, when he gets into a situation where he's comfortable, you know, his personality comes out, and what a funny guy he is.
Oh, look, I can just, I mean, you know, Brian Nankervis and Julia and the whole crew, you know, they're all music lovers. They're not out to be sycophantic or anything like that. I imagine that they would have given Broderick every chance, and all their musicians every chance to feel comfortable and enjoy themselves.
Yeah, I don't think it was that. I think it was just, you know, the conception of Broderick. You know, I don't want to do a cheesy television show, or, you know, I think he mentioned that he'd been invited to the ARIA Awards, and you know, and you know, just found the whole thing just, you know, a tedious, you know, waste of time. So yeah, interesting stuff, but yeah, we all digress. Right.
We have, but that's what makes the show, Michael, the digressions. So Tightrope. Haven't got a whole heap to say about this, you know. So it's got that classic Oz pub rock feel, you know, very sweaty, and even features, I think it says in the liner notes, the AAV staff party, who are singing and cheering when Brod sings in the chorus, and they went louder and louder and louder, and you have what sounds like a drunken staff party singing along in the background, and glasses clinking. This song uses the metaphor of the risk of walking on a tightrope for entering a relationship, you know, with the singer's friends, saying, look, that relationship is not one you should be going into. It's a common theme, but regardless, it's a pretty cool song anyway.
It is, as I said, my favourite on the album.
All right, so next one, High Rise. This is another one of those songs that, I guess, like Faded Roses, I see is very cinematic. I guess the first thing, when I came back to listening to the album lots in preparation for the show, I saw this as the musical equivalent of a particular film by a director called Ken Loach called Raining Stones. I don't know if you have you seen that one, Michael?
No, can't say I have.
It came out, I don't know, maybe about 10 years ago or so. And Ken, he wrote this film about the hardship of this man who he's barely making ends meet, and he lives in a high-rise apartment. And his only way of making business, I think he runs a delivery truck, and his truck gets stolen. I guess a little bit like the bicycle thief. But he gets his truck stolen, and that's his only means of making money. And he has to, he wants to have his daughter taken to church for communion or something like that. And that means everything to her. So she's got to have a nice dress, and she's got to have nice shoes, and you know, doing the right thing in the church, which means so much to him. So he has to borrow money from loan sharks. But of course, you know, that's not going to go happily. But this whole thing, you know, a lot of the film is set in his apartment, in this high-rise apartment. And I read what happens in this song, the desperate times that the protagonist in the song is singing about. And it just really made me think of that film. The song is basically the feelings of a guy living in this high-rise apartment building. He's struggling with his life. He's in financial dire straits. And once again, you know, his lyrics paint this picture. And he sings, high-rise, woke up in a cold sweat. Venetian blinds chopping up my silhouette. Damn the lies, haven't got the rent yet. Baby cries somewhere in the basement. And I love the picture painted by, you know, these Venetian blinds line. You know, that's really cinematic. And you can imagine that crying baby somewhere out of sight. You know, someone's, you know, probably at their wit's end and don't know how to get the baby to sleep. And they're not making money and they can't pay the rent. It's just, it really paints a very, very bleak picture.
And see, mate, this shows me the difference between us, that you're a lyric guy, and all I really sticks in my head about this song is is what Mal Eastick is playing on the talk box.
Well, all right. Well, talk about that. Talk about your Peter Frampton moment.
And Mal Eastick really is, although an integral part of the big combo, he's really very subtle in a lot of the tunes. But this one, he gets the talk box out, which if anyone saw Stars back in the day, Mal Eastick in Australia is the king of the talk box. He did wonderful things, and as you said, Frampton and Joe Walsh, but Mal Eastick was the man in this part of the world. And when I was 13 years old and stood in front of the stage at my high school and saw him play a talk box, it just blew my mind. He drags it out for this tune, and I think, it gives a texture to the tune that I guess it's just a nostalgic thing for me. Love to hear Mal Eastick break that out. But I also love the rhythm section in High Rise. The John, again, I've said it probably three or four times already, what a great drummer. But Graham Thompson, also fantastic bass player, an understated bass player. He played in Stars as well.
Okay.
And a very much underrated bass player. And what these guys are doing in this tune particularly, for me, they're just in each other's pocket. And I'm a sucker for a rhythm section. And I love this tune. This is probably my second favourite on the album.
Okay. One of the so this is co-composed between Broderick, Mal Eastick, and Mick O'Connor, and I think thus far we've not really said much about Mick O'Connor. Now, in this part of the world, he was known as the Reverend.
And what a great, and I must admit, when I was a kid, there were a few sounds that I had an aversion to, and one of them was the Hammond organ.
Oh.
And in later years, it's turned around. I love it with a passion, and we've done some recordings with my band, and the guy that owns the studio is a fantastic Hammond player, and it just blows my mind. And I really, that's maybe why, as we spoke at the start of the show, where I have a bit of a problem with some of those old Springsteen arrangements that I had a cringe factor back then, but now I've totally turned around, and the Hammond, on this album is just a highlight the whole album. And Mick O'Connor, as you said, is a genius.
He certainly was. He was highly revered in this country back at the time. I don't know what's he doing now. Do you know anything?
Not actually sure. I haven't heard. I can't say I've heard his name pop up since.
Real shame.
Maybe your listeners can write in and fill us in.
Please do, listeners. I mean, look, you know what? If we put out a word on Midas Touch, we'll get about 10 responses within 10 minutes, I'm sure.
That's good.
High Ride, certainly a great song. And so I got to return just quickly before we go off this song once more to the lyric, just because, once again, the cinematic image that it paints. He sings, "Down the pylons they caught up with my brother. I heard the fighting come through the louvres. I ran out in the street, tried to even up the score, found him on the pavement, can't take any more." This character, as if life isn't bad enough for him, the local thugs or the local loan sharks or whoever have beaten the shit out of his brother, and he sings that line, "I can't take it anymore." He's at the end of his tether. This is not a song that ends happy. And admittedly, I am going a lot for the lyrics in these shows, but I'm determined. I'm going to do an instrumental album there somewhere, but I'm not quite sure what I'm going to. I can say some stuff about the music, but I get to put to these shows. I love talking about the lyrics, and especially because I'm finding that a lot of these songs, which I'd taken for granted and sung along with over the years, now I'm sort of forced to read through them. And there's some really great lyrics here, and it's almost like great literature. Those guys have really done a treat on this song. We'll leave that one. Now, I've got absolutely no notes written to back off Baby Brother. It seems like a song a little bit more that's filler to me. So, I don't know, do you have any opinion on Back Off Baby Brother, the song that would end off side one of the final?
The only thing that really springs to my mind about this one, and I love the piano intro on it, but
if there was any
comparison to Springsteen, this is the one for me that would say, I can sort of hear that. But again, it's a great example of Mick O'Connor and Broderick how well they work together. They've, you know, there's a lot of work with those two guys on this album, and it's not a standout song, but it's I think it's quite an interesting song, and I guess I enjoyed it a lot more going in back and listening to it again, and the sort of different ears from way back 20, 30 years ago, whenever it was.
Did you get the re-release of this, or you still have your old vinyl?
I've got the CD, and it's they've done a great job.
Yeah, certainly have beautiful liner notes and great photos. Full kudos to Aztec. I'm just so taken, as I said at the start of the show, they're like the Rhino Records of the Australian music scene, you know, reissuing all these great albums. And really, it's certainly looking through my eyes, touchy sort of thing. Well, you know, Aztec could go on forever, but there's so much stuff out there that's otherwise never going to see the light of day, you know, at least not legitimately, if they don't do anything about it. But this is not an album I ever thought I was going to see on CD. So.
No, and been out of print probably for a good 30 years indeed.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so side two of the vinyl, or track six of the CD, opens up with a really lovely tune called I Was Here. And once again, I'm going to do the lyrics thing, but before I speak about the music. But what's really nice is, you know, it's a three-verse song, and the first two verses really sort of go and paint this perfect picture of a joyful day or a joyful time in the singer's life. I mean, presumably Rod's playing the character. It's not necessarily him singing as him, but, you know, his character is just sort of remembering some idyllic time spent out in nature and just, you know, hanging out beside a lake or, you know, just watching the birds in the trees. And this is not a hippie song, folks. It's just, he's just painting this, you know, really lovely picture here. And then he gets to the third verse, and, you know, he sings on a tenement and pylon, on walls and in the street. Someone tool a piece of chalk and wrote eternity. So he's letting you know, right, okay, the first two verses I'm singing about this beautiful time of nature, but my reality is here I am, probably the same guy who's living in the high rise of two songs previous. But then he finishes off, and in a silent moment, my brother's shout serene echoed out of Mirror Lake. His words were strong and clean. And, you know, he sings, I was here. No one can take that away from me. I was here. So no matter, you know, the fact that he might have this crap life and might be living in this high rise, which is causing him much grief, but he can still take some sort of courage and some sort of joy out of this one beautiful memory out of his life. And, it's a beautiful piano-based melody there. And Rod sings with all the passion that he can muster on it. Just a lovely song. And that's actually my chief Springsteen moment on the album, I think.
And I think, and I hope people will write in and tell us if we're right or wrong, but this may well be the last tune recorded that Andy Durant wrote, or co-wrote. So okay. I don't recall anything coming out after this. So, and it is a beautiful tune, and Mal Eastick and Andy Durant really did write great tunes together, and this is an example. Project, of course, was part of this, and I'm not sure if that was after the fact or not. But Mal Eastick and Andy Durant really were, you know, a great songwriting partnership, but such different musicians. Like Mal Eastick is very much a Paul Kossoff sort of guitar player, and Andy Durant was very much even a West Coast sort of guy sound-wise.
Yep.
But they just worked so well together. And, as I said, I think this may be the last Andy Durant song recorded. So I'd be interested to know that.
Mm-hmm. All right, so next song on the album. This is probably, for me, I think the weakest song on the album. It's Fortune Favours the Bold. There's no complete, you know, shambles anywhere on the album, and even this song has a couple of lines that I really like, but for the most part, this one doesn't work so well for me. You know, it starts off sounding like an experiment disco almost, for a large part there's the lyric sounds like the sort of thing that you hear, you know, done as a motivational song before a football match. let's shake our fists in the air and, you know, fortune favors the bold and you must be brave and must be strong. And, really, I think the song to me seemed a little bit out of place. But even in this song, there's still a couple of great lines. Well, small things break and tear and fall apart, small memories get washed away, and you're right back there at the start, looking out on a brand new day. Now, that's a lyric I like, but the rest of it's more like the fist clenching stuff. I don't know. Am I wrong on this?
I love the title. The title is just, you know, it's just one of those titles where you, it's, you know, when you go to write a song, when you come up with something like that, it's like, wow, where do you go from there? Yeah, it's probably not one of the strongest tunes of the album, but I find it interesting that it does rock along, and it's got a bit, it sort of takes me a little bit back to the opening tune where it sort of, you know, runs along like a train a little bit, and I really like Malisic's guitar playing again in this, and it, again, the rhythm section is great, and I actually, this song stuck in my mind seeing the guys live, and I saw them with the, and I can't, on a number of occasions, I can't remember which rhythm section, because there was some different guys in the band. Peter Lee was the drummer for a little while, I think maybe before the album came out, and folks may remember him from a very much loved Adelaide band called Stylus, who were...
Oh, yes.
I know you like Peter Couples.
And, I love Peter Couples, yeah.
Yeah, he's a fantastic singer. And James Gillard was also, for a period of time, the bass player in the Big Combo. And if you haven't heard of James Gillard, there is no one in Australia this man hasn't played bass for. So if you're a country music fan in Australia, I defy you to find one country record that he is not playing on. And he's actually out in the last, or in recent years, playing with Leo Sayer. And this guy is a phenomenal bass player. But again, I digress a little.
No, please. That's what makes the show pleasant. Anything more?
No, like I said, this song, apart from, you know, I do agree that it's I wouldn't call it a filler, but it's certainly not a standout tune for me.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, we'll get to the next song then. And this was either the first or the second single. I'm going to make the Springsteen comparison, but not for the music, more for the so-called controversy that it created. I'm talking about My Father's Hands. Now, I think that this song is really greatly misunderstood. Where I make the Springsteen comparison, I think in the Springsteen case, well, I'm talking about Born in the USA, I think, like, he always complained about how people misunderstood. It wasn't a jingoistic song. It was, you know, recounting the return to the states of a returned Vietnam War vet, and how he finds life hard. But given that a lot of people don't really listen to the lyrics, Springsteen had himself to blame for recording that song as a big stadium anthemic type of tune, and, you know, he'd played in these stadiums and have the American flag behind him and beat his fist in the air, and you know, no wonder Ronald Reagan wanted to use it in his electoral campaign. Now, My Father's Hands is a song of much more modest and simplest means, but the one line in the chorus, "Lucky to be an Australian," was, you know, stupidly accused of making this song jingoistic, and nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, I think, you know, basically Broad wrote this song really about his father, who, you know, was an immigrant to Australia, and found satisfaction being able to work with his hands and use that hard-earned work to feed his family and help his help raise his family. And he just sort of thought that he was living a better life in Australia there than he was from where he'd come. And it wasn't so much, you know, Australia, my hand, my heart, Australia forever. It's just, I'm really lucky living in this country under these circumstances, which I couldn't live where I was.
Yeah, for me, it has a similar sort of feel, sort of sentiment to the Sounds of Then, the Gangajang tune. Mm. And the can be easily sort of taken out of context. But, you know, this song, I guess, was the most popular song from this from this album, and it should have been number one, and it should have been a huge hit around the world. It is just a magnificent tune.
I love the Latin feel to it, sort of. Well, Latin, maybe not Latin, but
the congas are fantastic, aren't they?
Yeah. Alex Patut, who was sort of like a session percussionist to everyone, I'm sure, back in the day.
Yes. Yeah, and it just gives it shows what you know, a little bit of percussion can do to lift a tune, or to just to give it something that just that takes you somewhere else. That you know, I remember, and I can't, his name eludes me for the second. Who was Elton John's percussionist? The famous
Ray Cooper.
Ray Cooper. I remember reading an interview with Ray Cooper many, many years ago on how a simple tambourine can make a tune, and it's true. And this is an example of you know, a simple percussion instrument taking the song to somewhere else, and it really works well. But I love the piano in this tune. It just sets the tone, and just
it does.
Never get sick of hearing that piano.
And I love I guess that opening 8 bars or so with it's basically, so you got Alex Patut playing away his pattern on the congas, and all John Annis is doing is playing a crotchet pattern, bass drum and ride cymbal, dum 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 dum, which by itself would have been absolutely nothing, but that combination of that and the Alex Patut percussion, it's such a great attention grabber.
It is, and it's a great example of less is more. What great arrangements can do with. I think to quote you, it's simple but not simplistic. Very brilliant stuff.
So yeah, no, great song. And I don't, how high did that single get on the charts back in the day? Do you remember?
Yeah, I can't remember. I think it did very well in Adelaide and Melbourne, but maybe not so well nationally. And that's the weird thing. I think in Melbourne and Adelaide, the combo was much bigger than anywhere else in Australia. And I guess because, you know, there were a lot of Adelaide guys in the band and based in Melbourne. And, you know, that was, quite strange how that sort of panned out.
All right. So two more songs to go. A song called The Devil Drive comes after My Father's Hands. And this, I guess, is another song that, you know, I mean, it's all right, but it's not necessarily my favourite. But, you know, this is another energy pub rock sort of driven song. It sounds like it belongs in an 80s film, in an 80s car chase or something like that. It's just, I don't know why that goes to my head. Is it something that goes to your head?
I guess so. I find this interesting because I think there's a backstory with this tune, that it was actually written about a real life truck driver that I think Broderick knew of. And I'm going to contradict myself, because lyrically I love the line in this song: "One hand on the bottle, one hand on the throttle." I just love it.
Yeah, no, that is a good lyric.
But for me, this song could have been a Cold Chisel tune. The start of this song is just pure Cold Chisel.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I guess I could see that. I guess the dominance of the piano on a lot of these songs could have, we can make the association with Don Walker. But I can't remember, is this the one which has some more of Mel's talking box on it? I can't remember either. Oh,
there's not a lot here, but there's a few little gems hidden away. You've got to listen hard to hear it.
Basically, the whole thing behind the song "The Devil Drives," as you mentioned, was based on someone who brought either new or new of, and it's sung from the perspective of a guy who, you know, drives a lot of overnight shifts, you know, delivering things, he's popping pills to try and stay awake, just sort of singing about his lot in life, and, you know, he's not necessarily happy with it, but that's what he does. So the song neither here nor there for me. But anyway, there it is. You have anything more you want to write about that song?
No, like I say, I guess that's one of the tunes that sprung out to me more listening to it in recent years than it did when it first came out, which is good, because I guess there's certain songs on an album that are there for you at the start, but as you listen to in hindsight, different ones pop out, and that's a nice thing about listening to an album and not having a rotating iTunes playing.
Yeah. All right, so we go to the final song, and the final song of the vinyl edition. There is the bonus B side from the CD, which I won't touch on, unless of course you wish to.
No, I didn't.
Okay, well we'll stick with the final song on the album. It really, I'd almost have preferred that they didn't put the B side, because the final song on the album, "Ruby in the Snow," is such a great album closer. And it's before I was saying that your man Tony Slavich was responsible for probably three of the better songs, or the three of the best songs on the album, at least in my mind. And "Ruby in the Snow," the album closer, is one of those three songs. Actually, according to the notes here, it says that it was a single.
And I don't remember it coming out as a single at all.
Mm. But there you go. It probably didn't get added to many of the radio stations' playlists. They probably thought, oh, well, we've done Faded Roses. We've done My Father's Hand. Yeah, nothing more.
Well, I guess because it's such a departure from the singles that had been successful. Mm. Yeah, maybe that's why I don't recall hearing it on the radio at all.
Mm. Mm. What I really like about this is because a lot of albums of the 80s and the 90s, a lot of albums that were otherwise full-on rock albums like this one is, they'd have a token ballad, but this is far from token, and it's not big or anthemic. It's quiet and heartfelt. There's some really beautiful, tasteful cello on it, and it's just a beautiful, sad song about the collapse of a relationship. It pretty much revolves around Mally Sticks acoustic guitar, some piano from Chris Wilson, and harmonica from Rod Smith. Actually, come now to think of it, there's not a whole heap of harmonica on this album.
No, there isn't. And if people have seen Broderick Smith play, he is an absolutely unbelievable harmonica player, and there isn't much in here. No, it's a bit like Mau Eastick's guitar playing. It's there, but it's quite subtle on the album. The big combo for me had a wall of sound. There was no real standout instrument.
Mm, mm. Exactly. It's it really is all about the band. It really is all about a cohesive sound. And yeah, sure, there are solos, but they enhance the song rather than enhance the player. I think we've spoken on another podcast due to come out sometime soon about serving the song, and I'd say that really that's a great strength of what made the combo big. They could have their cake and eat it too. You get these moments of Mau Eastick's talking box guitar, or these Mick O'Connor organ solos, or a little burst of harmonica from Brod, but none of it takes away from the band as a whole. They really do sound very cohesive, and each one knew what the other one was thinking. Probably none more so than in this absolutely gorgeous song. As I say, it's a relationship breakup song, which Rod seems to do so well. I don't know if he's had a lot of relationship breakups in his life, or if the irony is he's happily married. I don't know, but
it's good fodder for a tune, whatever.
Yeah. So what I like about it is the song takes a slightly different tack the breakup. He says that he attributes the problems in their relationship to his partner's lifelong avoidance of responsibility when things got rough. He sings, "You didn't understand even when you were a kid, did you? When the things got rough, there was always somebody that hid you." So, this is not a recent thing. It's not like ever since we've been together. As long as you've been around, I happen to know for a fact that even as a kid, you couldn't take the heat. You were always getting other people to do your dirty work for you. And then he also sings, "You're always the one to run when the ground is covered with ice. Cry and catch me if it looks like I'm going to slip. But there's sweat on my hands and you're just too far away." And he's saying, right, you know what, I've had enough. So work out your own problems. And it might sound insensitive, and we certainly don't know, his partner or ex-partner's perspective on things, but with the music that goes along with it, it's absolutely heartbreaking. It doesn't sound nasty or arrogant on Rod's part at all when he combines that voice. I'm dropping the Springsteen reference. Yeah, he's now Van Morrison. That Morrison-less like voice. Morrison-esque like voice. And that just really very sympathetic instrumentation to the song.
And then this is for me. This was one that I overlooked when the original album came out, that I've gone back to now. So there was a lot of things popped out this time that didn't when I first bought the album. But it's interesting, this tune features, I think, the first association with Chris Coffey, who folks may remember from as a keyboard player with Procol Harum many, many years ago.
Yes,
But he popped up, and I believe he lives in Australia.
Okay.
And he popped up as a guest musician on the Dingoes tour a couple of years back.
Oh, and, wow.
And it was just fantastic seeing him. And he was a great keyboard player. And, just sort of added another dimension to the Dingo. So, you know, I think this is the... And I'm not sure how Brodrickal got to know Chris, but from my understanding, this is sort of their first musical outing together. So that's a musical... friendship that endures till now.
So I have not heard much of Roderick's solo albums since this. So he's appeared on some of his other recordings, has he?
I'm not sure about Chris, but uses a lot of young local Melbourne players too. Just fantastic, and mostly guitar players. It's really worth checking out his solo recordings in the last. I think he's probably made maybe 10 albums in the last 15 years, and a lot of them are out on the ABC Records, and really they are magnificent albums indeed. You will really worth. I think Rod's got a fairly good website that you can actually grab some of his stuff on, and I thoroughly recommend it. His solo recordings are different to the music we talked about tonight, but magnificent indeed, and show off. Again, what a great songwriter and vocalist he is.
All right, well, we've come to the end of that album, which really means that we're probably close to the end of the show, this is probably the first show in a little while that's going to be going under the 1.5 hour mark. Not quite under the 1 hour mark, but 1.5 hours or so is still reasonably respectable.
Well, you might want to actually hit the pillow before 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yes, I think I would. It's school night, so got to do that. But on the way out, I've got to pay tribute to some of the other podcasts that I love to listen to, and urge you listeners out there, if you're not already fans of these shows, to search them out. As I've mentioned on previous shows, I'm a big fan of a lot of film-related podcasts. So in the order of filmic podcasts, I'd like to say a big shout out to my good friend Dr. Zom and Pickleloaf out there at Silver and Gold, Terry Frost here in Melbourne, who hosts the most excellent show, Paleo Cinema. He's about to record, I think in a couple of weeks, episode 98. So within a month or so, he's going to be doing episode 100, quite a feat. Of course, he's got quite a way to go before episode 300, like some podcasts I could name. But we'll get to that.
I have no life.
I'll have to ask Terry if he has one. Paleo Cinema, if you like listening to a breakdown and analysis of cult movies and black and white movies, You know, he basically covers his modus operandi is anything that's over 20 years old. And it's not not chick flicks and not religious-based films, then he'll pretty much watch it and discuss it. Not always favorably, but that's fine too. But he always brings new insights to a lot of the films that he talks about. Actually, funnily enough, I got onto him way back at episode 69, where appropriately he was talking about Alvin Purple. So Paleo Cinema, Terry Frost, out of Melbourne, a really excellent program. The Mondo Film and Video Guide, I think you can get that at mondofilmpodcast.com. That's hosted by a fellow called Justin, Mondo Justin, and I'm very excited because the next episode of Love That Album, I'll be co-hosting with Justin of Mondo Film Podcast, because as well as being a big film nut, he's also a big music nut, and we'll be covering the Paul Simon album and film One Trick Pony, but we'll be taking it from different perspectives because he loves One Trick Pony as a film, and I don't.
Paul Simon's mum.
Yes, exactly. Look, I have to say, since I recently watched it again in preparation for the show, and I don't dislike it as much as I first thought. I still think Paul Simon's acting sucks. But look, I won't talk much more about that. We'll leave that to the episode. But a big shout out to Mondo Film, Mondo Justin, who, if you stay tuned, I think middle of March, he'll be releasing, like, I think all of March's episodes. I think about 8 or 9 episodes. And basically his modus operandi is to talk about one film per show. But like for that month, he'll pick a different director or a different actor to talk about. And this month, it's going to be Jerry Lewis. And the list of people who he's got to speak on the show with him about Jerry's films is absolutely phenomenal. Writers, co-stars, and there's even a chance he's getting the great man himself. So, I'm just really so excited for him. Not quite as excited as you getting Fee Waybill on sitting in a bar in Adelaide, but nearly
I'm
as excited.
I'm pretty excited.
Mondo Film Podcast. Girls on Film. Now that's an international production, so that features Rach out there in Perth and Emily in New Jersey, and I'm not sure there's another couple of the girls who speak on Girls on Film. Now they had a very long hiatus, but they've just come back into the podcasting world after about 7 or 8 months. They've been well and truly missed. They dipped their toes in the water the other week by doing a pre-Oscar show, which I guess is a fairly safe thing to do, but starting in the next week or two, they'll be coming back talking about genre films, cult films, horror films, which will be a treat. It's always basically they sort of their modus operandi is to talk about films that are typically considered blokey films, but from a chick's perspective. So I urge you to search that one out. That's also a really great program. And, of course, the doyen of film programs, the GGTMC, Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, hosted by Samurai and Large William. The latest episode, which I downloaded last night, I'm sort of halfway through, they're talking about a great film from 1978 called Magic with Anthony Hopkins. Now, I've been listening to it, and they keep on saying Anthony Perkins. I don't know, they've got a thing for Anthony Perkins, but guys, it was Anthony Hopkins who was in that film. But a great film, which made me sort of think back at the time of a Twilight Zone episode about a ventriloquist dummy that goes nuts. So, check out the GGTMC. What else? Okay, so in the land of music podcast, there's the List Music Podcast, featuring Ricardo, Juan, VK, and Jenny out there in Los Angeles, and they're talking every week. They pick a different topic, their favorite drummers or their favorite guitar players or their favorite Christmas songs, and they count down their top five, and they have a great discussion. They play little selected clips, and I'm just really loving their show. They're a young show. They've been on since beginning of December. And I'm waiting for them to send me a promo so I can play it on my show. But I'll give them the shout out anyway. You really need to listen to these guys. TheListMusicPodcast.com. And finally, a big shout out to, I don't know if you've heard this program, Michael, it's called Sitting in a Bar in Adelaide.
It's vaguely familiar, but I'm sure it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, yes, yes. And they're approaching something of a milestone?
300 coming up soon, as you are my co-host, and people will be able to have a listen to that very soon.
Yeah, look forward to that coming out on air. That'll be good. We'll be discussing, for your listening entertainment, our favourite drummers. And even if you're not necessarily into drummers per se, we'll try and make it as interesting as possible for the general populace. But if you are a drummer, well, feel free to write in and tell Michael or myself whether you think we're on target or not. Yeah. That's it. Sitting in a Bar in Adelaide. And that can be downloaded at?
AdelaideRockShow.mevio.com is the actual website, but you can get it on iTunes and just about any podcast directory out there seems to have pirated it somehow. So
fantastic.
It's out there.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. So just other little housekeeping things. I'm always keen to get feedback. I've only had it a couple of times, but if you wish to write in and say things that you enjoyed about the show, hopefully, or things that you didn't enjoy about the show, it's all good. I'm always wanting feedback. Albums that you think I should be listening to or Michael should be listening to, please write in. You can send an email to me at rrkitchen@yahoo.com.au. And when I say send me an email, you can either do that in the traditional written form, or if you want to create an MP3 voicemail, that's also fine. I'll play it on the show. So happy to hear from you in any format that you care to take. And in the last couple of weeks, I've gone and created a Facebook page for the program. So I suppose if you just go into Facebook and search for Love That Album, you'll find it. And be happy to have you join the Facebook page. And basically the whole idea behind that is we're just going to sort of create discussions on a daily or every couple of days on a different music topic. So you want to come in and say, talk about an album that you really love. Look, I remember, someone went and wrote about an album that they thought sucked, and another member of the group went and said, look, hang on, I thought this was supposed to be a forum for talking about things that we like. Let's stay positive, guys. But I could see where he could get upset about that. But really, look, anything you want to talk about music, like, dislike, please feel free, join the Facebook page and get involved in the community. Love to have a few more members. So I think that's pretty much covered it for this time around. So we'll have to have a discussion as to what our next album is going to be, or do you have one in mind, Michael?
Well, I think Stars must be on the list, and we also mentioned last time we spoke The Stranger with Billy Joel, so that's a couple I'm keen to do. So we're never going to run out, you know that, don't you?
No, we're never going to run out. Look, I sort of thought to myself, look, if I can keep this program going for, a few months, I'll be lucky. But I really think at the rate of going, I think this is going to be a long-term project, which pleases me no end, of course. Doesn't help my sleep patterns very much. But, the sacrifices we make for the cause of our muse.
Isn't that right? As the great man, John.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.